Traveller's Tales.
Welcome to Traveller's Tales here on Premier Radio, the 500th edition. I'm Patrick Forbes, and my traveller today is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What's your earliest recollection of bumping into God?
I think my earliest recollection would be really of bumping into Jesus rather than God. That's to say, my first recollection of religious faith is very much to do with the person of Jesus. It's to do with the stories of Jesus. It's to do with picking up a little picture book at the age of, I suppose, 4 or 5, which was about the healing of the blind man in St. John's Gospel. And that stuck with me as a focus for thinking about God, thinking about myself. And I guess that's why my Christianity has always been, in many ways, very focused on the person of Jesus.
Did you grow up in a family that took you to church or sent you to Sunday school?
Yes, we went to church every Sunday, Presbyterian Church in Wales. And I went to an enormous Sunday school of about 500 children.
Wow.
Very, very organised, very successful, where we did the scripture examinations and we had anniversary celebrations with everyone memorising verses. It was pretty intensive, really.
How did the journey go on from there?
We moved house when I was about 11, and the village we'd moved to was very different from where we'd come from. There was no Presbyterian church. There was a Methodist chapel and a Congregationalist chapel and a parish church. And we went to the Methodist chapel for a bit, and then I decided I'd like to explore the parish church, and I dragged my parents along to the parish church and found there a very new atmosphere, very exciting indeed, very, very stimulating at every level. Very beautiful worship. It was quite high church, not over the top, but not what I was used to. The music was wonderful. I joined the choir very promptly. And the teaching was first class. We were taken seriously, I think, and expected to grow and develop as Christians.
What did your parents make of it?
I think at first they were a bit baffled, but they joined in. We were all confirmed together on the same night, eventually.
That must have been rather good to be confirmed with your parents.
It was, I think. It cemented a real shared commitment to that wonderful local church, which I still look back to with huge appreciation and gratitude.
What was it like moving on then to university and having to sustain your faith somewhere else?
Well, I'd already, I think, decided that I'd like to offer myself for the ministry. And after lots and lots of turmoil and upheaval about what kind of Christianity I believed in when I was at school, you know, did I want to be a Roman Catholic? Did I want to be a Quaker? University was an opportunity to explore all that in greater depth. I read theology and was very active both in a local parish church and in the college chapel. So it didn't feel like a period of strain. I know some people experience it like that. It felt much more like a period of enlargement and exploration.
And growth.
And growth, yes. And beginning also, I suppose, from the age of 16 or 17 onwards, beginning to explore what it meant really to pray and learning a bit more about silence and a bit more about contemplation.
What was it about ministry that attracted you?
It's quite a hard question to answer, but as far back as I can go, there was some attraction about that. Part of it was the attraction of taking responsibility for the faith and passing it on, communicating it to people. So initially very much a teaching and sharing sense to it, but then more and more a sense also of the pastoral, of the need to care for people and try and assist them not just in knowing things, but in moving towards God and finding God as the source of their consolation.
What did your family make of the notion of ordination?
They got used to it. I don't think they were wildly enthusiastic about it. It didn't look like a terrific career prospect. But they were never hostile at all to it, quite the contrary. I think my mother nurtured secret hopes that I'd be a lawyer or a surgeon or something like that. You know, something serious.
My mother was a member of a family that in every generation until hers, there had been a priest or a minister. Mm. And it was growing up in a succession of grim vicarages and rectories that I think persuaded her two brothers not to have anything much to do with the church.
We had no family connection at all, really, with the church, so it was unexplored territory. But, yes, on the whole, they were supportive.
So at university?
At university, again, a period of tremendous exploration. I felt my calling to the priesthood at that time a little bit wobbly. It wasn't an issue of faith at all. But I was very intellectually excited about theology and very much wanted to research and teach. And there was also the nagging feeling that had been with me for, a few years. Should I try my calling as a monk? And that caused a fair amount of soul-searching over those years. But generally I look back to the Christian environment at university with great gratitude. I made very good friends at a deep level, many that I'm still in touch with, who were able to share some of the vision with me.
What was it in the end that persuaded you against the role of a monk, that path?
I can't put my finger on anything particular. I thought about it and prayed about it for years, really, and it wasn't until I was about 27 or 28 that I thought probably not. And it was something to do with having rediscovered a sense of a calling to the priesthood as such, not particularly the monastic life. And that had a good deal to do also with the fact that I taught for 2 years in a college attached to a monastery in Yorkshire, the College of the Resurrection at Murfield, which gave me plenty of opportunity to think, well, is this the kind of life I want to stay with? But also because I was teaching candidates for the parish priesthood, thinking, here are these people of great quality going forward into their calling. It's not a small thing. Maybe I ought to stay with that. And very gradually things came together, and out of the blue I had an offer of a position combining teaching and pastoral work in Cambridge, and that seemed somehow to click.
Did you enjoy Cambridge?
Hugely, yes. Yes, I did. I worked in a council estate in the parish, as well as teaching at the university.
Chesterton,
St. George's Chesterton, another parish that I owe a great deal to. And that, I think, really, really forced me to ask questions about how I was communicating and how I could get on the wavelength of people in that kind of culture, not to mention children there. And it took a while.
Considerable challenge. What helped you?
A brilliant vicar, again, Brian Watchhorn, who was there for quite a while and went on to be Dean of Pembroke College in Cambridge, and the people themselves, who would not pull their punches if they thought you weren't making sense or going off on your own private adventures. Mm. And I remember very particularly in that context the experience of a house group that I used to convene, going through 1 Corinthians with that house group, celebrating Holy Communion with them very informally in my front room. And that sense that what the Bible was about was what this group of people was about, people making that connection. That was a tremendous strengthening reinforcement of my own faith, I felt.
It's often seen, isn't it, that ministry is giving out and giving out and giving out, and sometimes people seem to forget that we receive an enormous amount from the people amongst whom we are set.
It's one of the best-kept secrets, isn't it? Ministry is... I'm not saying ministry is entirely selfish, but you do get fed, of course, in ministry tremendously. You have the privilege of being invited into people's most vulnerable and significant places, into their most sensitive moments, birth and death at crisis, and to see how people live through those. In a sense, that's what becomes the raw material of preaching and communicating. What's the good news like? Well, let me tell you what it was like for so-and-so, because I've seen it work.
After Cambridge?
After Cambridge, I went off to be a professor at Oxford, and the professorship was attached to a job at the cathedral in Oxford, and that meant a quite intense daily rhythm of services, choral evensong, and also morning prayer with the rest of the staff of the cathedral every morning. And that, in terms of prayer, was a tremendously settling and stabilising thing. There was this community, almost like a monastic community, in fact, every morning, quite early, filing in to a dark cathedral, saying morning prayer. And there would always be one or two of us who'd go a bit early and spend time in silence before morning prayer. And I think over those years, even with big changes in my personal life, the arrival of our first child, even with that steady rhythm of prayer that was just going on and being able to slot into it and lie back on it like a mattress almost, that was the important aspect of those years.
It's an undergirding, then.
It's an undergirding. I always remember a talk that was given by a Roman Catholic monk, a Dominican called Simon Tugwell, years ago, when he pointed out that the Hebrew word for trust simply meant lie back on. And when you say you trust God, you lie back on God. And I think in prayer, when often we're tempted to be hyperactive and anxious and wordy, we need to be reminded that what it's all about really is letting yourself be upheld.
I'm actually spending some time at the moment learning meditation in the Benedictine style, and that is both challenging, scary, and immensely, I think, rewarding.
I'm sure it is. And for most of my 20s, I suppose, the person who meant most to me as a spiritual guide was a Roman Catholic Benedictine monk on the Isle of Wight, who was someone to whom I could take all my problems, someone who really, to me and many, many other people, represented the welcome of God in the most simple and direct way imaginable. And he was someone who would give quiet advice on all these things about prayer, but also advice about the great decisions of life.
Were I ever a professor, and there's no way I would be, I would worry myself silly about trying to keep ahead of my bright students, and I'd perhaps worry about losing the whole parish aspect of ministry.
Yes, I think both of those ring bells. I was lucky enough to have over a dozen really very good research students when I was at Oxford, and learning from them, being stretched and pushed by them, was part of the intellectual excitement of those years. But you're quite right, it can be easy to lose sight of where it really roots itself down. So two things helped there, I think. One was that the cathedral, of course, involved a certain amount of straight pastoral work. People still did come to ask for advice and counselling. And also, my family started going to a church in East Oxford, in a very, very mixed area, sort of old Oxford working class, immigrants, young families. And I got into the habit of going with them perhaps one Sunday in the month when I wasn't on duty in the cathedral. Got to know the parish very well, started doing a little bit of pastoral work in the parish and preaching there. And again, I'm still in touch with people in that parish and felt that that was an absolutely necessary way of just keeping in touch with the circulation of the blood in the church.
What was it about academic theology that fascinated and excited you?
Seeing the interconnectedness of things. I can still remember a moment in my third year as a student at Cambridge, walking back from a lecture and suddenly having this feeling that all sorts of things were coming together in a way I'd never expected, and feeling a real excitement in my veins that, yes, it all made sense. I see how creation and redemption and the Holy Spirit and all the rest of it, how that fits, and it's really beautiful to look at.
What next, after Oxford?
Well, the rather surprising invitation to go back to Wales as a bishop, and a whole set of new challenges about communicating, improving my Welsh to the point where I could, I suppose with some degree of plausibility, preach a sermon or deliver a talk in Welsh from time to time. And also, again, learning how to communicate with some very deprived communities and parishes in South East Wales with heavy unemployment and all of that. Learning how to communicate, once again, with young people without very much education and finding that enriching in the same way, but also finding a very, very strong sense of, well, the absolute need for God in that. Somebody asked me a few months after I first became a bishop, what have you learned? And I said, well, that it's absolutely necessary to believe in God in this job. You know that you can't do very much
in your own strength.
And, yes, great confidence in a way, not in my capacity, but in God's purpose.
Was it a great shock being asked to be bishop?
It was quite a surprise. The then Archbishop of Wales had sounded me out a little while before and said, what would you think if? And I thought, well, quite a nice idea, but it won't happen. And it did. But it also felt like a way of reconnecting with the pastoral heart of the ministry.
And did you find the time that you'd spent at Oxford and Cambridge a huge help and a resource?
In a funny way, yes, because all this business of trying to see the patterns, trying to see the interconnection, it does mean that when you stand up to preach in front of a group of teenagers in Abertillery or whatever, you've got a picture in your mind, you've got a sense of the coherence of it, and you can speak out of something. You're not struggling to hold the things together. And I did find that, yes, that all those years of theology had given me quite a well of things to draw on.
And when did poetry figure?
Oh, right back as a teenager, I suppose. Like most teenagers, I wrote some perfectly dreadful poetry, some of which was published in the school magazine, I'm ashamed to say. And then in my late 20s, I suppose, I rediscovered poetry as something I could do, not quite in the way I'd done it as a teenager, but perhaps a bit more seriously. And I'd read more poetry by then, digested more ideas and images. And ever since then, it's gone on as a steady background.
Is it a counterpoint to theology?
No, it's another aspect of the same process of discovery, really. Poetry is listening for connections. It's listening for the echoes between words and the resonances between images, just like theology in many ways. And I've never seen them as rivals, but as
complementary
parts of the same process of trying to listen to God and open up to God.
And then Archbishop of Wales.
Yes, well, I could see that one coming because I was the senior bishop in Wales by that time, and on the whole, the senior bishop tended to get elected as archbishop. And we just had almost a clean sweep of bishops in Wales. Many people had retired, lots of very new bishops in office, so I thought, well,
Buggins' turn.
And some challenging but basically quite happy years as Archbishop of Wales.
Looking back on it, do you yearn for a church disestablished?
Well, I've said, I think, that disestablishment doesn't kill the church. I've seen that in Wales, and that seems evident. It didn't collapse in the way many people thought it would. But the reason that I resist disestablishment now is that when people talk about it now, they seem to treat it as part of a general secularizing program. You know, let's get religion out of the public eye, out of the public sphere. And I think that's probably worth resisting. I don't think that's a good idea for us at all, and I don't think it's good for society, never mind the church.
I think I heard recently that there was a move within the BBC to downgrade religion and ethics and make it part of lifestyle, whatever that is.
Well, these crises come and go. I think there still is a fair bit of commitment in some circles in the BBC to this, and certainly the existing religion and ethics people are very committed and produce work of very high quality. But it's all part of the way in which, in context after context in our society, there's a kind of pushing to the edge.
Comparing the work of the Archbishop of the Church in Wales to Archbishop of the Anglican Communion, or the primus of all, how big a contrast?
Enormous, really. Working in Wales was working in a small church which was fairly homogeneous. There weren't great extremes of opinion. There were real divisions, of course, and we had to deal with the women's ordination question like other churches. But essentially, we knew each other quite well. We couldn't quarrel too badly because we were too close to one another. And suddenly, you're in a huge global setting where the cultural differences and the theological differences are huge. And that's where I think it's important to hang on to the idea that it is God's church. This isn't an institution that I have got to run, or not just that. This is the assembly of people who have been called by God into the fellowship of his Son. Now, the fact that we've all been called into the fellowship of his Son doesn't make us agree and doesn't make us easy to get on with, but it does say the foundation is not our agreement, the foundation is the act of God, and therefore there's always grounds for hope.
Nonetheless, the scale of the job would keep many a strong soul sleepless, if not drive them mad.
Yes, well, I haven't gone completely mad yet, but the sleep patterns do get affected from time to time. And somebody said it's seven different jobs. You have to be the chair and the president of the bishops in England and be the senior bishop of the Church of England. But that entails with it a kind of obligation to comment and intervene in society on the issues of the day from time to time. You've got the international work, the constant travelling abroad to see churches in other contexts, and all that comes from that, which can include work that we've developed quite a bit in recent years, and that is looking at the development needs of churches and trying to broker assistance for churches in really poor contexts. And there's the simple work of being Bishop of Canterbury, and being in the parishes in East Kent whenever I can.
What helps you survive and grow and deepen your relationship with God?
primarily the daily round of prayer. Fortunately, Lambeth is a house of prayer, not just an office block. And starting every day early in the chapel, moving through morning prayer and Holy Communion each day, that is the absolute anchor. And everything falls into place around that and in the light of that, I think. But I'm still a theologian, of course, so I like to read and explore, and to read and explore things that will enrich and strengthen what I believe. And on top of that, of course, I'm blessed with a family who support me and pray with me.
Married to a theologian?
Married to a theologian. So we can even talk about the technical stuff from time to time.
How difficult is that? I mean, finding time even to talk theology with Jane.
We've sometimes said that one of our problems is that our timetables don't always coincide, so that when Jane is eager to talk about theology because she's just come in from a lecture or is in the middle of writing something at 10 o'clock at night, and I've finished a rough day in the office, they don't always dovetail. But we do talk about theology a lot. We do share what we read, and we take each other's advice about communicating the faith, and that's a wonderful enrichment.
How do you relax?
Listen to music, going to the theatre. We all love theatre. Walking when I can, which is not often enough.
Music? Which music? What music? What do you like?
I like 16th century music, Tudor music, lute songs, things like that. And I like Bach. And I could really listen to Bach for most of the rest of my life.
He's written enough, hasn't he?
He's written enough, yes.
Enough to keep you going. Mm. What about prayer? How does prayer work? How do you do prayer?
How do I do prayer? First and foremost, settle the body. Get your body in a position where you don't have to fidget or wriggle. And for me, that's developed into sort of squatting on my heels with a prayer stool in the mornings. Breathe deeply and get a regular rhythm in your breathing. Let your breath go right down to the pit of your stomach. And then let the words come, just the very simple words, Jesus, have mercy. And let those words float on your breath and keep doing that. Let that become a kind of second nature as the period of prayer goes by. Ideas and concerns will come and go. Images will float across your mind. Let them, not the end of the world, but come back to the central activity, which is just breathing in the spirit, so to speak, and letting the name of Jesus rise out of the centre of your being towards the Father. I've always seen it as a time when we are, if you like, invited into the life of God, the Holy Trinity. There is God the Father inviting us. Here is God the Son giving us his name. Here is God the Holy Spirit supporting us and breathing in us, as spirit, of course, means. And so when I pray, that's what's going on. It's the life of the Holy Trinity coming alive where I am and where the praying people of God are.
And do you manage to defend to the death your times of prayer?
I have to be quite strict about morning times. I think without that it really would be incalculably more difficult, if not impossible. And I try to do the same when I'm travelling or away from home increasingly. I've had patches where I really haven't been very good at that at all. And I look back actually on the time when I was a bishop in Wales and when our second child was born, and letting quite a bit of that slip and not doing much more than just saying morning and evening prayer, and then feeling very dry after a while and knowing I absolutely had to go and open up the choked well again.
And is it the same with the Bible then?
If you say the offices of the Church of England, you get to read an awful lot of the Bible every day. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts that ministry in the Church of England gives people. There is that round of daily readings, Old Testament and New Testament, morning and evening, day by day, every day of the year. You can't get away from it. But the difficulty is, not the difficulty, the challenge, the opportunity, is reading it so that it has the power to keep on saying new things to you. And that means reading slowly rather than quickly. It means reading thoughtfully rather than dutifully.
Do you have a favourite book?
The Gospel of John, closely followed by 2 Corinthians.
Given half a chance, to whom would you give a nice Bible Society Bible and why? We'll do it with enormous pleasure.
I think I'd like to send a Bible to one of the new academies that are growing up around the country. Many, of course, sponsored by the church, but not all. But I think we've got an extraordinary opportunity in that a lot of young people have absolutely no idea what's in the Bible, and that's a good thing to the extent that when we talk about it, they don't think they know it all. It's fresh. And I think to present the biblical story, especially the story of Jesus, the parables of Jesus, the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus, to present that for the first time to young people in school is a great privilege.
Do you get to visit these academies from time to time?
I do, yes, and visiting schools, that's one of the most important parts of my...
So if we got a really good, special Bible and got it to you, then you could give it to an academy.
I would present it.
Grand, that's what we'll do then. Archbishop Rowan Williams, thank you very much indeed for being my traveller today. Listen again, same time next week, for Traveller's Tales. Bye-bye.
Traveller's Tales.